Come to Madrid and visit incredible museums and art galleries. Discover charming stores, enjoy delicious tapas, and take a stroll in the capital's new Riverside Park. There are 100 different reasons to visit Madrid, and once you've lived it like the locals, you'll never want to leave. Madrid, a way of life. Madrid City Council, campaign co-financed by the ERDF.
Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 92, we're in London, and we'll be crossing over to Tokyo in a moment for an update on the political backdrop to the Japan disaster.
One can be critical of what the government has been doing, but on the other hand, it's a terrible job to have for anybody. I should first congratulate Kan for not having fled yet. All of his predecessors were so short-lived under lesser pressure.
That was Koichi Nakano, professor of political science at Sophia University in Tokyo, and we'll be hearing what the mood is like at this year's Baselworld Watch and Jewelry Fair.
A lot of people have been saying certainly the problems in the Middle East have kind of changed the figures of who's coming from there, but overall the mood is pretty positive and buoyant now. The fair's incredibly busy, and the buyers are still here.
That was our Tom Morris, and later in the program, culture editor Rob Bound talks to Jason Wood, director of programming for Curzon Cinemas, about the latest must-see film releases.
Amongst all of the great films that showed at London, you know, high-profile films, Never Let Me Go, Black Swan, with huge amounts of talent, I think The Great White Silence was the one that's really had the cineasts salivating.
And now, from London, The Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, March 27th, 2011, and you're with The Monocle Weekly. Here in London, I'm Tyler Brulé, along with my two regular sidekicks, Andrew Tuck, Robert Bound, and, well, our third wheel, fourth wheel, Steve Bloomfield.
Fourth wheel, hello.
Fresh from Doha.
Indeed, yes.
Well, we'll come back to, we'll talk a little bit about that assignment in a moment, but look what happens, I go to town for a few weeks, and the wheels well and truly do fall off. It's nice to see all of you.
Nice to have you back.
Thank you very much. A little bit of Hong Kong, a little bit of Japan, and now back in Cozy Corner.
And you always seem to be in Asia when things go wrong. You've had a few kind of...
had a few of those along the way. Actually, it was quite funny. We did the program from the studios of RTHK. You think that a public broadcaster in Hong Kong is going to just have, you know, the latest Yamaha everything. And it's actually this very quaint, both TV and radio setup, you know, public service over on the Kowloon side, just full of like lots of charming people making kind of nice educational programs. I think there's a story in it. We have to, lots of yummy mummies who seem to have their own morning shows as well. You'd like it, Rob?
Do bakery shows work on the radio, do you think?
I think they could.
Could do, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm up for a bakery show.
I know you are. Tuck's Buns.
It's still waiting in the wings, that show.
Andrew, have you been anywhere?
Well, actually, I did go to the launch of a cookery book about cakes the other night.
Okay, of course.
Which was very nice.
Very good.
You don't always have to go to kind of highbrow things, you see.
No, Rob, we're going to talk a little bit about, I guess, one of the highlight trips of the week that you had as well. But we'll talk about that during culture, I think.
Let's save it.
We should.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, people are going to want to... It's a cliffhanger, isn't it? Shall I allude to a house of wax?
Okay, yes. we'll leave it at that. Steve, you were in Doha. We don't want to give the story away. There's a lot happening in Doha, and there's not a lot happening in Doha. But you were doing a piece on one of the bigger brands that's sprung up from that country.
So I was doing a story about Al Jazeera and how Al Jazeera has been covering the uprisings and what that means for Doha and Qatar as a country as well. But yes, you're right. There is not a lot to do in Doha. Once you've stopped working, there's about two good restaurants, including Carluccio's,
right?
Just like in London, exactly the same menu, but very, very, very different prices.
Okay,
when
can we read about that?
That's in the
not
next
about
issue.
Carluccio's, but
my review of Carluccio's is no. The piece is in the next issue.
That would be the May issue.
The May issue, yeah.
Which we've almost put to bed, haven't
almost.
We?
Almost.
Well, no, we've got another 5 or 6 days to run.
Yeah, hold on. There's a little bit to go, yeah. And there's a few people around the table who've still got some copy to hand in, so let's not pretend that it's actually almost done.
Don't look at me, Mr.
Piece,
who's he talking
actually,
about,
Actually, all Rob? Three of you. Actually, all three of you.
But when you're out there, I think we should probably move to the south side of the Mediterranean in a moment, but a couple of highlights, aside from the culinary delights of Qatar, but...
Al Jazeera tissues.
Well, this...
They have their own branded tissues.
Yeah.
So we
how many
stole
boxes
a couple.
Did you nick? I was going to say.
we stole a couple from the makeup room. One of which is now on my desk with a. It's got a nice little flourish to it.
Yeah, it's very nice.
And the Al Jazeera branding on.
If I follow you this week and you start crying,
exactly, they're there.
One thing I wanted to know, and I'm not sure if you're going to touch on the piece, is how integrated are the various services? So are the newsrooms sitting side by side? Is it an when you watch Al Jazeera English, you see that big swooping crane shot over the newsroom. Is that that the English language newsroom and then there is the Arabic newsroom next door?
Indeed. It's the English one that we see there. They're actually over the road and people in English refer to them over the road. And there's this sort of little track.
What do the Arabic speakers say about it?
Probably best not to say. And the Arabic station's very, very different. It's quite 70s. It's quite cool. Lots of stacks of videotapes all over the place. A lot more dish dashers over on that side of the road. And also what was interesting, being there at the time when the news in Japan was at its biggest, Al Jazeera English was leading with what was happening in Japan quite heavily, the first 10 minutes of every hour. Whereas over Arabic, it was Libya, it was Palestine, it was Yemen, it was Tunisia, it was Bahrain, and then there was a little bit about Japan. So there was a very sort of different take on what was most relevant to their viewers.
And do you get a sense of that there is sort of an uber news editor as well who is watching output on both? And I'm not sure if we're talking about maybe the Emir at this point, but I'm wondering, just the balance of what the Arab channel is doing versus what the English channel is doing. Is someone...
I think they're fairly free to do what they want. I mean, I think they have a meeting every day where they sort of go through the running orders for each one so people know on both sides what the other one's doing. They obviously work together a little bit in the field, particularly during the uprisings when they had teams in Egypt. They were at least talking about security issues.
There is a lot of doubling up. I mean, there's distinct crews, distinct correspondents. It's not...
Yeah, oh, no, completely. Well, I mean, just recently, Al Jazeera Arabic, about maybe 3 months ago, had an interview with Omar al-Bashir in Sudan. And the English team were like, oh, God, we should get one of those as well, and had to try and arrange a separate interview. And Bashir, being very nice, said, yes, okay, I'll give an interview to you as well. But there was clearly a sense that the English side thought, oh, we don't want to be scooped by the Arabic side. And, and the other one was quite interesting was David Cameron was in Qatar a few weeks ago, and he decided to do an interview with Al Jazeera Arabic. And the English side, again, were a bit annoyed that he didn't want to do an interview with them. But, I mean, for him, obviously, it was more important to speak to the Arabic world rather than the English world.
Yeah. I mean, Andrew, it was interesting... I guess probably from from Saturday, Sunday, when the bombing campaign started, it was almost like the inversion of the news pyramid that you were talking about, that suddenly Japan just disappeared. I mean, even whether you're watching Sky News, you're watching BBC News 24, you're watching CNN, I mean, everyone was there, and Japan was really 2 minutes at the end of a one-hour bulletin at that point. Did that slightly surprise you?
But it's just been extraordinary for all of the news channels at the moment, the kind of jostling of big news stories. So it's funny that, even I think 2 days ago, Libya was actually pushed down the agenda in the UK behind budgets, behind things happening in Japan. So some days it falls off. And I think the strange thing about the Libya story is there is very little what you might call war porn. You're not seeing the bombing images that you saw coming out of Baghdad. So you see these, you see what the Gaddafi regime wants to see you to see around Tripoli. And outside near Benghazi, there's one or two trucks exploded. But really, there hasn't been the imagery to sustain it always at the top of the news agenda.
No, and it seems like it's almost library footage, isn't it, Rob, when you see these F-16s and Tornado fighters, firing up at the base in Trapani in Sicily. Those could have been, NATO images from 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. You have to look at the registration number on the airplane. I mean, a lot of RAF Marham and things like that. But no, it is. I guess it's funny, as I said, as we've talked about with previous stories, it seems like actually it's still a really, really good radio story. Mm. It's been covered really brilliantly by the radio because it's so much easier, obviously, to get audio out than visuals.
Mm. Steve, the NATO Secretary General, Mr. Fogh Rasmussen, has been saying that this is really about a no-fly zone. This is about protecting the Libyan people, and this is also about the Libyan people making their own decision. Is that something? Does it work that neatly for NATO?
I think pretty much everything that's happened in terms on the diplomatic side and now the military side has been slightly farcical at times. From the very first moment when the Arab League said, we want a no-fly zone, it was a fantastic opportunity for the West to say, okay, great, we want a no-fly zone too, we'll help you do it. And instead, there was this desire amongst, certainly from Britain and France, less so from America, to be seen to be leading. Well, we'll lead, we'll have a UN resolution, we'll get this in place. The UN resolution was then actually quite different from what the Arab League had signed up to. And, in the early days after the resolution, you hear all these news stories that, oh, well, Cameron's had a phone call with Obama and Sarkozy's had a phone call with Obama. No one's saying, well, we've been on the phone with Amir Moussa. No one's on phone saying we've been, you know, talking to Turkey. And, you know, these are the key people. You know, Turkey and the Arab League were the key people to get on board and make sure that they were, you know, backing it completely. You know, we say there's been, you know, very little war porn. What little there has been British and American, you know, fighter planes going off, loaded up with bombs. It's all been about that. When, you know, this is supposed to be a coalition that's supposed to have Arab support. Yeah, where are the Qatari jets? Where are the Emirati jets?
The only thing is, I think if you'd waited around for the Arab League to kind of take the lead, nothing would have happened. Benghazi would have fallen. They finally said, yes, let's do something. Mm. It's taken this long to get two Qatari jets there and a bunch from UAE. They were willing finally to say something, but they didn't have the guts to do anything. And that's the problem with the Arab League. And that's why I think they're discredited as an organisation, because actually on the first day they were sweating and panicking that, you know, that something, you know, a few bombs had been dropped, and that they wouldn't be able to kind of carry along their little kind of team. The problem is that they've got to kind of actually be seen to act, and they've been kind of scared to do that, I think.
Well, I mean, I think that's right, but I still think there was an opportunity to show that this was an Arab League-led process, which I think was missed. And I think, you know, there's a problem now that it's seen as Western attacks on Libya, you know, rightly or wrongly, because there isn't the Arab support there was. You know, where it goes from here is quite tricky, because now you've got a situation where, you know, NATO's taking on the no-fly zone but isn't sure whether it's going to take on the airstrike attacks. You know, there might be some Qatari jets involved. One of the interesting things, I think, is with Egypt. You know, Egypt's had, you know, $1.5 billion of military aid from the US every year for the past 30 years. You know, why doesn't it have the capability to help out with the no-fly zone?
Mm. That's also, I think, the other thing we've for so long sort of, you know, thought about, you know, the various missile batteries that the Libyans have. And we've sort of, you know, we've sort of thought about this kind of rather scary arsenal, which is sitting on the far side of the Mediterranean. But it all looks a bit sort of slapdash. I mean, Robin, we were talking about in the office that it seems, you know, anyone who's managed to get their hands on a clapped out, you know, Russian tank, it's like they're sort of in a Mazda dealership, but they want to go take it for a drive immediately.
Yeah, exactly. It does seem a bit like, it seems like really 70s. Even the military equipment seems like library pictures, like real library pictures, when libraries had books in.
Well, also because there were so many extraordinary, you know, or I think we've been weaned on so many propaganda images of, you know, these, you know, battalions of female bodyguards and all of these, you know, these goose-stepping masses, etc. Where are they?
Well, I mean, that's the other thing as well. I mean, we know he's got some weapons because we sold them to him, which, you know, which I guess also helps as well, is that you know what it is you're fighting against. But yeah, I mean, the ease with which the Brits, Americans and French have been able to take out the air defences, you know, be able to impose a no-fly zone fairly quickly is militarily, you know, very impressive, and has certainly helped bring us to where we are with this stalemate. But I think the thing that the West has to work out now is this as far as we go, or have we now picked a side? If we have picked a side and we're with rebels, do we start arming them? And that's a question I think the West has to start to at least think about. You know, is there a way to break the UN arms embargo? Is there a way to get Egypt to perhaps deliver some arms across the border? Because at the moment, what it looks like is a stalemate. Mm. And who knows how long the appetite in the West will continue for the no-fly zone to still be enforced.
I mean, Andrew, as NATO was saying, that you know, they're going to let the Libyan, you know, people, you know, get on with it. But at a point, I guess, as, you know, Steve is saying, you know, they are going to have to, you know, go one way or the other, and there will have to be some type of involvement on the ground. Now, whether that's advisors or whether it's sending cargo ships and, you know, into Benghazi, what do you think happens?
Well, I think that is the problem. There is undoubtedly, there's not a clear end to what the mission is. And they're very happy for the Libyan people to get on with it as long as Gaddafi's gone by the end of it. Mm. And that's actually the same for the Arab states. That's actually why they kind of ganged up on Gaddafi in them, because they've all had enough of him and they would like him to be gone. But as you say, what's happened is that the rebels have actually proved to be more incompetent than anyone thought. They're a real kind of ragbag without any leadership, kind of shooting each other by mistake, not knowing how to kind of fire any of the kind of armaments that they get. And without kind of putting somebody on the ground to help them and advise them, you know, whether that's kind of, you know, troops or advisors, it seems impossible that they're going to be able to take the whole country.
All right, well, gentlemen, thanks for that. We're all limbered up now for a Sunday morning, aren't we?
Yes.
Absolutely. When we come back, we're going to cross over to Tokyo to talk to our Asia Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson about the state of Japan. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're in London. We're back after this. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where we're going to cross over to Tokyo now to talk to our Asia Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson and also Koichi Nakano, Professor of Political Science at Sophia University, to see how things stand 2 weeks after the series of disasters that struck Japan. Hello, Fiona. Hello, Koichi.
Hello there.
Hello. I thought, I guess, to start, and in part because we have Professor Nakano on the line as well, but I guess perhaps the obvious question 2 weeks in is, how is the government faring? You know, certainly when we talked last week, you know, there was this talk of, you know, an opportunity that potentially Nakano could shine. It seems that it's certainly been the cabinet secretary more than anyone else who's really been in the spotlight and holding things together. But I'm wondering how both of you see things faring so far. And Fiona, I guess maybe you could start.
I think it's, you know, it's a mixed picture. People are obviously very anxious still. They're frightened. The water and food contamination issue has really taken over in Tokyo from the earthquake and tsunami story, which is obviously bad news for the people in the north. But in Tokyo, that's the preoccupation. And I think there's I don't know what Koichi thinks about this, but there seems to be a mixture of mild panic about water, certainly if you go to the supermarket and the shelves are looking very empty, and a need for more information. I think the picture on health information has been really mixed, which has been very frustrating. We're getting mixed messages from different people about whether it's safe or not to eat food, whether it's safe to drink the water, and lots of rather vague terms like there is no immediate danger to health being used, which I personally don't find very reassuring.
Mm. Professor Nakano, do you think that's really been one of the biggest issues and where we sit now 2 weeks into this, that it really shows the failings when you have a political system where you have new leadership every 9 months to a year, and there is really no solid voice, and with no solid voice, perhaps not particularly evolved crisis management?
Yes, I mean, one can be cynical and say that I should first congratulate Kant for not having fled yet. I mean, he, all of his predecessors were so short-lived under lesser pressure, and so far Kant has stayed put. We don't see him that often, but maybe that's not so bad either. And so I think one can be, critical of what the government has been doing, but on the other hand, it's a terrible job to have for anybody in the business anyway. So I think the kind of issues that Fiona mentioned, I think, is really preoccupied in the Japanese people's mind at the moment. And for the most part, I think the Japanese don't really care that much whether Kan is doing a good job or not, because we don't really look up to the government for that sort of thing, but rather want to get more information and try to make decisions by ourselves how to protect ourselves.
Mm. I mean, Andrew, do you think that if this country, meaning the UK, Canada, Australia, if Australia had been hit by a similar sized tsunami and earthquake, and also experienced something on the same scale of a nuclear crisis as well, would the government there be faring any better?
Well, I think the interesting thing is how it's been played out. If it was here in the UK, certainly the PM would have to be there the next day. He'd have to go up by chopper. He'd have to be emoting on behalf of the nation. He would have to try and somehow be the voice of all concern. And that doesn't seem to happen in Japan, that it's much more a kind of creeping officialdom the way that this goes along. There's no way that you could have prepared for this event. So he's obviously kind of always going to be kind of struggling to keep up.
And Fiona, Andrew raises an interesting point. We'd heard that Kan was supposed to go up and pay a visit, and I'm not sure if it actually happened or not, because there was talk about it wasn't great weather for helicopters, and he was going to do a tour, then he didn't. Did it actually happen? Did we miss something?
No, it didn't happen. I mean, the weather was used as an excuse. I think Koichi's absolutely right that, I mean, Kan is just not the type of leader to rally the people in that way, and I don't know many Japanese politicians who could, to be honest. And yeah, I think there is certainly news coming out that people within the exclusion zone are feeling isolated, slightly abandoned, because obviously people feel that the area is contaminated now. So I think it would have been a great support. And I don't know if maybe Koichi knows if there are more plans for Kan to make another attempt.
I do not know of any plan at the moment. I think that sort of symbolic gesture, I think, has not been done by Kan, as far as the Fukushima nuclear plants are concerned. And I don't even think that it's really very high up on the government agenda for the time being.
Koichi, have we seen anyone from corporate Japan almost step into the breach and take, you know, almost a more official role, or take, you know, take more the role of that any CEO would take in a time of corporate crisis. I mean, we've seen, you know, a number of quite strong voices from the Japanese corporate scene being critical. But you know, has there been anyone on NHK Radio on the Japanese service that maybe we wouldn't have seen in the West who's been vocal and certainly been you know, a bit of a leadership beacon?
Not really. I mean, when you think of that, I think, you know, the TEPCO, the electricity company, who's, of course, running the nuclear plants that are now under out of control, you don't see the president of that company either. I mean, you see the vice president all the time and the, you know, lesser-ranked people. But maybe it's to do with different type of leadership role. Because, you know, there are other people who ask me that sort of question. But, in fact, it really didn't occur to me even that much, because we don't really look at that sort of leadership, you know, kind of visible in your face, in shirt and, you know, on the ground. And I guess the whole reconstruction and containment effort is regarded as more of a collective enterprise.
Mm. And Fiona, over the past week, I think just, you know, probably since, you know, Sunday or Monday, we started receiving a lot of notes from the PRs from the major Japanese corporations, and whether we're talking about, you know, automotive or certainly on the building side, who are, you know, asking us, you know, what our views about a bounce back Japan conference. It's interesting, and none of them unified. And maybe that's why I was asking Koichi the question, that there seems to be, you know, a will and a momentum on the part of PR teams, and whether these are being driven by multinational PR agencies and then feeding it back to the internal teams and CEOs, but there seems to be some momentum building that we can't just have, you know, certainly fundraisers in terms of music, etc., but there needs to be something which is done from a concerted corporate level to get people focusing on the future of Japan. Are you hearing anything else like that?
Well, I think, you know, for a lot of companies, they're really just concerned with getting their own manufacturing started again. I mean, when you think that Toyota, these huge companies, can't get their production started again, I think that's a real issue. And I think there are manufacturers all over Japan. It's emerging more and more how many components would have been coming from that region that are critical to a production process that now are not appearing. And it's really stalling things. Even Japan Tobacco is now saying it will have to stop shipping products from Japan until the middle of April.
Hi, this is Steve. We were talking earlier in the show about Libya and how the media's attention has sort of switched from Japan almost entirely to Libya. I was wondering, do you think that matters? Is there a sense that, do people feel that the world sort of switched off from this story now?
I think, you know, a lot of Japanese were really very encouraged by the outpouring of support from the international community, both at the national level and on the individual level. But this is a crisis that we are in, I think most Japanese realize, for the long term. You know, we are not going to monopolize the Western attention to Japan. And we do understand that, you know, what's happening in the Middle East is also of great relevance for the world. So I think for the time being, I think we would be happy to have thanked for your attention at the initial stage. And we are now still trying to control the, you know, nuclear power plants. And hopefully we can grab your attention once again when things are under control.
This is a question for Fiona. I wondered what's happening on the TV. I mean, in the West, we've been giving a sense of narrative about this disaster and then about the cleanup. But what's Japanese television saying? Is it more about being useful? Is it telling you information about what sort of water you can drink, what sort of, you know, how near and far you can be from certain places and all the rest of it? Is it more of a sort of information service than a news service at the moment?
I mean, I have personally found it quite a useful information service, because NHK has just been running endless reports of news conferences, footage from the north about what's happening there. So it has been quite useful in that sense. And the coverage is very, I wouldn't say flat exactly, but it doesn't have the highs and lows of, say, Western reporting. It doesn't do the sort of sensationalism, although even that's a bit too strong a term. I don't want to criticize other media outlets, but it does generally just pass on the information. So I've actually found it quite useful. I mean, now, of course, exactly as Koichi said, I think people are really coming to terms with the fact that we're not going to recover from this in a couple of weeks. This is a long-term situation, and the health situation, radiation problems, these are really long-term things. And I think that's something it's just sinking in. And I think that's a lot for people to come to terms with. And that's been coming through on reports. The anxiety of people on the street, I've noticed, has been raised, certainly in the last few days.
Professor Nakano, do you think that if you were part of the Khan advisory panel right now. Do you think he does have an exit point or an exit date already planned, that, you know, he waits another 2 months, another 6 weeks, and then, like we've seen with everyone else, okay, I've done my bit, my crisis, good or bad, but now it's time for me to go as well?
I doubt that, because in a way, I think if Khan ends up being very successful at what he's tackling, and if the containment works in, like, let's say, in 2 weeks' time, and now everybody feels secure, then I think you'll be exactly at that juncture when Khan would be receiving all the criticisms, not for the success, of course, but for the failures. Because even if the situation is contained, of course, the damage is done already. And so if, you know, anything of that sort happens, then he may have an exit date. And maybe he would, you know, even if he didn't want to, he'll be forced out. But I think given that this is a problem that's going to be lasting for quite a long time to come, I think for him to, you know, plan an exit is actually very difficult. And my guess is that this may happen at a later stage, but at this point, I think they're still trying to contain the best they could and try not to worry people excessively by meeting out information here and there.
Finally, just for both of you before we go, if we look at, you know, a lot of the international financial dailies, weeklies, etc., you know, everyone, and even ourselves included, we've been talking about the bounce back story, is how this is, you know, a nation which, you know, in a large part also, you know, the economy is driven by tearing down and rebuilding again. And, you know, most of these stories, you know, they do end on a bright spark that, you know, Japan has always been able to rebuild. But Fiona, I'd like to ask you first, does this not, of course, the country's not been through anything like this, but what is the mood? I mean, when you see those stories, do you buy it at this point?
To be honest, I think the mood has changed in the last week. I think the effects of the contamination are going to be so widespread, it's going to affect people in agriculture, restaurants, fishing. I mean, it's going to cut through so many industries. And then we still have this big issue of the big industries and how they cope. I don't really think people are yet in a position to really think about bouncing back. I mean, I would say the mood is, of course, people want to get on with their lives, and people who left Tokyo are starting to return. But I still feel there's just such an anxiety, and I just don't think people are quite ready to feel that positive about the future yet.
Mm. Professor Nakano?
Yeah, no, I agree with Fiona. I think, you know, my own mood, in fact, you know, varies every day. You know, when I hear some good news or some good development, then I feel more positive. But then when I hear, you know, disappointing news, then I feel we are done with. And so I think many Japanese, I think particularly in the eastern part of Japan, because mind you, in the western part, I've been taking visits from time to time, but people live pretty normal life. I mean, it's almost like nothing happened. But in the Tokyo area and up north, I think the situation is still so precarious and so critical that we have yet to make up our mind what to think about the future.
Mm. Fiona Wilson and Koichi Nakano at Sophia University, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly in London. We're back after this. Back to Monocle Weekly. This week, over 100,000 visitors descended on Basel in Switzerland for the annual Basel World Watch and Jewelry Show, where 1,892 brands from 45 countries are exhibiting. We sent our Tom Morris along to find out what the mood was in the exhibition halls and if there is finally a sense that the downturn in the luxury goods sector has been overcome. And he's on the line from Basel right now. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Tyler.
Tom, I wanted to start. We were talking to Fiona and Professor Nakano in Tokyo just before we came to your segment, and I'm just wondering what the mood is, because, you know, we've certainly been hearing that the likes of, you know, Louis Vuitton and other luxury goods companies are bracing themselves because Japan is still the world's biggest luxury goods market. And I wonder if that's affected the mood at all, or is it still quite buoyant there?
It's still very buoyant. You walk around, you hear a lot of Asian accents. I think, because I'm out here with Takaharu, and he's certainly seen a big Japan presence too. I'm not sure whether that will reflect in the numbers. I think a lot of people have been saying certainly the problems in the Middle East have kind of changed the figures of who's coming from there. But overall, the mood is pretty positive and buoyant now.
When you've been talking to, I guess, marketing directors, CEOs, you know, people on, you know, in the design teams for these brands, is it a focus right now? The obvious sort of Southeast Asia, China. But when you say that it's buoyant, is it also that, you know, America's also bouncing back as well? What are people saying?
I think, I mean, to be honest, walking around, you hear very, very few American accents. China is obviously a massive, massive component. What I find quite interesting is there's a lot of brands who have come from China and they've been over here in a sort of separate hall at Basel. And they're sort of slowly learning to brand themselves like the European brands. And I've spoken to one that sort of, you know, do a tourbillon watch for about $8,000. So it's very interesting to sort of see how, you know, the market is changing. Obviously, there's a customer base there and has been for a few years now. But the Chinese brands are coming up in themselves almost. Certainly, they're not Rolex, but it's very interesting to see that sort of part of the market change.
But do you think with those Chinese brands, these are companies, and of course, you know, as I'm sure probably most listeners are aware that, you know, there is, you know, even for the Swiss companies, there's a huge component business. There's a lot of importing from China with a lot of final assembly happening in Switzerland. So of course, the Chinese companies have been learning from the Swiss for a very long time. So do you think if it's a Chinese brand, they want to make a name for themselves in Basel, but, you know, their sales are probably still to a domestic market. They're not hoping to land a big order from a shop on Bond Street in London.
Oh, no, absolutely. And actually, you know, when you actually sort of try and go into details about how many they're selling, it's still very, very few. The Chinese customer, they still want Swiss made. And all the Swiss brands, you know that full well. So you can see sort of taste being played to the Chinese, because I think, you know, the watch industry didn't go through the recession that many of the other luxury markets did. And I think they sort of have the Chinese customer to thank for that. And I think they're very appreciative and still kind of approaching the Chinese customer quite wholeheartedly.
I mean, you touched on that point about, you know, specifically sort of, you know, tailoring to a Chinese customer. I think we did see a few years ago, when the market was looking a little bit saggy, that some of the very august brands were slightly pulling their trousers down, doing things they might not have done before. Because, you know, and I remember going to one watch company, and they had, you know, dhows, you know, on the Arabian Sea on the watch face, and they were saying, oh no, it's just because, you know, it's a special, you know, lunar anniversary, and that's why we've decided to do it. Are you seeing the same thing with lots of dancing dragons or rabbits?
There are a lot of dragons, and actually one of the brands, they did a limited edition watch. I think there are a lot of eights in the number of the limited edition because that's a lucky number in China.
Oh, I thought you said lots of apes.
A lot of dragons and a lot of apes.
Right.
So there is that. But I think all the buyers I've been speaking to, I think the common consensus is that the Chinese customer, their tastes, their knowledge, their education has become incredibly sophisticated. They know all about the technology and the complications and things. So they're much more discerning than certainly people would give them credit for. And I think, you know, so the kind of the market is almost meeting in the middle between East and West now. And you do see that with some of the trends that are going on here, which is kind of a golden age to watchmaking almost. Lots of nice, simple shapes, much slimmer, which is obviously what the Chinese customer likes. But certainly, you know, what the Western retailer and buyer and customer is looking for is, of course, it's still there. From the major brands.
I mean, aside from a slimmer profile, but what else would you say is going on? If I just to put you on the spot, sort of, you know, four or five main trends that you're seeing at the moment.
What I've been quite interested to see is, you know, it's sort of well documented that a lot of the fashion brands have been going into sort of high complicated watchmaking. But actually, you know, the likes of Louis Vuitton, Chanel, Hermes, they're really, really lovely watches. And now their presence is actually really important at Basel. And certainly some of the nicer watches we've all been seeing are from those brands. In terms of the way they look, there is this return to the golden age of watches. So, you know, you're seeing a few pocket watches now put onto straps. A couple of brands have done that. Certainly just the kind of paring down now. There's much less sort of vulgarity and bling, but then a lot of the people I've been speaking to says that actually there's not much variety here. There's not a great deal of diversity.
Just when you talk about maybe this return to sort of simplicity or just, you know, good old-fashioned watchmaking, I'm sort of reading that as maybe more watches at an entry-level price, perhaps a little bit of sanity returning to the market, that people, you know, maybe some of these brands feel that they need some more entry points because you can't just score with, you know, 100 watches, you know, that are priced at €265,000.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, Hublot have just released a £2 million watch, so dripped in diamonds, so they're obviously still that part. But, you know, there are...
Happy birthday, Andrew.
You needn't wrap it.
I'll bring back a couple.
Tom, it's Rob here. Having walked the avenues of Baselworld a couple of times myself... Yeah. And they are avenues. I wanted to ask you about that. When I was there, the Hublot stand, for example, some of the other brands had these huge, phenomenal things that are like houses. What have been the sort of slightly nuts sort of spectacles of the fair?
Oh, well, is these entire sort of apartment blocks sort of dumped in this, you know, expo centre. And they're absolutely huge. You sort of look up from the floor and at first, you know, in the main hall where there's the Rolex and the Patek Philippe, but you look up and they sort of go off of three or four floors and you see through these glass doors and windows where all these, you know, the buyers are taken and sort of presented. It's absolutely vast.
It's like Madison Avenue or something.
Oh, totally. It's like walking down Bond Street. So.
And that's what's remarkable. These don't come down either. You know, they're there all year. I mean, this whole...
They're there all year because it's cheaper to pay the rent throughout the year, you know, apart from the week that it's on, rather than a sort of disassembling it and storing it somewhere.
Finally, just before we go, Tom, if Andrew, you know, gave you £100,000 bonus, you know, which might be likely, what booth would you be beating a path to?
Well, I've spotted a very nice new yacht master from Rolex, so that's only about, I think about 17, so I'd have some money left over.
Perfect. Excellent.
Your order's in now.
Good. So you can charter a plane back from Basel. We look forward to seeing you back in the office.
Already have.
Great. Tom Morris in Basel, thanks very much.
Thanks, Tyler.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. You're back with the Monocle Weekly in London, where it's time for a little bit of bass, a little bit of brass. What is that? What else does that rhyme with, Rob?
Well,
sass.
Okay, that's good. I'm glad you took it in that direction.
Give us a sassy segment. we were saying earlier that there was a comparison going on. It was sort of Wednesday or Thursday in the office of what were the most crap invites of the week, you went off down Marylebone Road.
I went. I took a 3-minute step up Chiltern Street. Over the Marylebone Road to Madame Tussauds.
And I thought you were kidding when you said that you were going to...
You didn't.
No, I did. I thought you were going to a film screen or something else. You certainly weren't going to be going to Madame Tussauds.
I got an important SOS from my friend who said, come to Madame Tussauds. They're unveiling a new doll. So I did.
So off you went.
And it was excellent. And basically, I think it was the launch of their what used to be the London Planetarium, a sort of for children sort of idea of the universe. A bit like Brian Cox's attitude to broadcasting. And they've turned it into a sort of huge Marvel superheroes 4D crazy extravaganza where things happen to you in your seat. Dry ice squirts out of the...
I beg your pardon?
Yeah.
So what is the 4D?
The 4D...
I know it would be in some cinemas.
The 4D... We are going to go on and talk about good films later.
Good.
And proper things in 3D later.
But in the meantime...
But in the meantime, the 4D is essentially a prong in the back of your seat chair. Some dry ice squirting out of the seat in front of you. When the 3D of the speedboat is jumping through the screen at you, you get wet. So it's and been when there's a sort of, you know, a roller coaster ride or a car crash in the movie you're watching, something smashes into the seats behind you.
So you pay good money for the experience you normally get on EasyJet, where someone's kind of kicking the back of your seat every time they cross their legs.
It's absolutely amazing. I think this technology has already been pioneered at the In-Flight Entertainment Expo. But yeah, no, it's good. And then obviously had my pitch taken with lots of the, not the sports stars, not the rock stars, but the dictators section.
Fallen dictators of the Maghreb.
Yeah, exactly. It was that section was thronged, which I would imagine is quite rare. No one wanted to have their picture taken with Tiger Woods or with David Beckham or with Justin Bieber, who I believe is the newest unveiling there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Old haircut or new?
It's the new haircut, but it's lacking the necessary Bieberish wispiness.
Right.
I would have said. I'm no expert, but
you obviously are.
I wanted to see sort of I wonder what their sort of policy on refreshing the models is, because in the A-list section there were A-list Hollywood stars, but also Tara Palmer Tompkinson. So I think did you
pay respects to Liz Taylor?
I don't know where
maybe she was brought off.
Don't say
no.
That.
They probably melted her down.
I did say that the night, but I thought I went out on the radio. But you have, so that's... but no, it's good. I wanted to see, you know, the Bowies and the Jaggers and, you know...
Well, on that musical theme, do you have anything for us this week? I don't mean to sort of, you know, shuffle you along, but you've got a double segment this week.
Double segment. Yeah, we've got Karen Ann, who she's a sort of fixture on the Monocle Hi-Fi.
Which is a whole other story.
That's why I paused there, because I know you've got something to say about that. Let's
No, we're going with a new Yamaha system, because there was one that I really, really liked, which I saw at a hotel in Sweden, which we bought. I had a couple in my flat, then I gave them to someone else, and it's been a problem actually finding something where we still need a CD player in the office, mm-hmm. and then it needs to have, of course, good sound, And then it needs to be able to fit on the windowsill. So we need vertical.
Yeah.
And the only verticality we've really had has just been the tissue boxes, which Rob and I are up in arms about.
They're not good, are they?
Not that we need a lot of tissue, but we prefer more of a sort of a bungalow style of tissue box.
I like the, yeah, the flat.
The flat, one story.
Like a one story flat brick, modernist brick.
I don't want a townhouse style tissue box.
Would you like to have a, like they do on the back seats of taxis in the Middle East, sort of
a cover?
A gold cover.
I don't know, but a gold one. But I thought sort
Come on.
I think a nice canvas one from Japan would be fine.
We can have a gold one.
We're
gonna have a cover off.
We could.
So Karen Ann,
yes,
is a cosmopolitan, wonderful artist. She's sort of spends her time in Tel Aviv, Paris, New York, and I think she's.
Where's she from originally?
She's born in Israel, and but I think she's mostly based in Paris. And I think she recorded this album in bits and bobs in those three cities. And the album is called 101, and this is called My Name Is Trouble.
That's very nice.
I hope it sounded as good.
No, you sold it well.
And
I mean, not that I'm sort of, I wasn't really hearing shades of Tel Aviv, but but I sort of felt the sunshine of the Eastern Mediterranean, which
yeah.
is great.
No, it's very cool. I can see that. I mean, the whole record's great. That's a really lovely track. But I can see that track being remixed like mad this summer. I can see that being a hit. It's got a really nice beat, and I can see them sort of building on that. So yes, that's great. That's out soon.
Should we include Andrew in the segment at all? Oh, hi, Andrew.
Hello.
Hello.
No, can I just say that? That is my kind of favourite song that Rob's playing at the moment.
Really?
I actually even said last night, can we have Karen Ann one more time before we get home, please? And I love that track.
Did you do it in that voice?
Yes. Because okay. That's the only way I can get him to do anything for me. I love that in your PJ Harvey album.
That's great. I thought it was in your PJs.
Well, you're welcome to do it in your PJs. But I've liked those are the two that are my most requested CDs at the moment.
Andrew is quite difficult to please musically, but once he likes something, you might have noticed this, it never goes off the, off the stereo. So it is sort of...
Is that a generational thing, do you think?
I like that. It might be
from the old days of putting the needle back to the beginning of the record, just play it again and again.
Yeah. When you had a record bag, you could only carry a certain amount with you. Now in the era of the iPod, when you can have your entire music collection in your pocket, you can switch between PJ Harvey back to Karen Ann and back again.
Well, Tom might be getting a new Rolex, but I think you're going to get a new iPod as well.
I need it. Well,
your iPod is like Andrew's old Toshiba double burner laptop.
It's brand new. Oh yeah, the Arga. Andrew's laptop, otherwise known as the Arga.
Anyway, next week you're going to have your new top-loading Yamaha double speaker iPod dock number. It's the most handsome thing on the market.
You can take it home
until we do our own. Wi-Fi radio.
Good.
Which is in development.
Yes,
it
is.
In Scotland.
I've seen a picture of that.
You saw a picture of it. It's nice, isn't it?
It's cool.
We'll talk more about that closer to Christmas. Well, we have another segment with you in a moment. So why don't we have a break and then we'll come back on the Monocle Weekly. You're back with the Monocle Weekly where... It's Culture Part 2 with Robert Bount. Hello. Hi again.
Back with a vengeance.
This is the more visual part of the show, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I spoke earlier this week with Jason Wood, who's the director of programming for Curzon Cinemas, who's always amazingly forthcoming. That's what he is as an interviewee. He's a very interesting man. And seems to, you know, obviously he's a passionate fan of film, which I think is probably rare. Most cinema chains... I guess their programmers get what wins an Oscar and they get it in and everyone watches it and that's it. So Jason's wonderful to speak to, very passionate. And in particular, he was queuing up Cave of Forgotten Dreams, the new Werner Herzog movie, about the oldest paintings in the world, the oldest in the south of France. This is Werner Herzog's first sort of departure into 3D cinema. So it's the
Not 4D.
No, there's no dry ice.
No one splashing paint in your face.
Reminded me of the... Anyway, so this is Werner Herzog's sort of first departure into 3D of a medium that he's criticised in the past. And it's nice to sort of see it being used for an artistic purpose rather than the sort of blockbuster superhero purpose. Anyway, so this is when I spoke to Jason earlier in the week. Now, Jason, you've got a fairly responsible job,
an art house sort of auteur sort of way of looking at the world, hopefully.
Yeah, we've been going now for 76 years, and we're probably the country's most successful independent UK exhibitor. And we do concentrate on showing specialised films. That's quite a broad term, but I guess it would mainly be foreign language films, documentaries, but also the more interesting films from Hollywood. So Black Swan was a big hit for us. Coen Brothers' True Grit was another one that was successful. And the ubiquitous The King's Speech was also a success for us. But we have a sister company called Artificial Eye, which are a distribution company.
And Artificial Eye is where we're going to kick off the film roundup right now. They're releasing Essential Killing. What is there in this other than, I think a lot of people have probably heard that it's a mostly dialogue-free movie. But yeah, can you just set it up for us?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Essential Killing is an interesting film. It's by a Polish director, an auteur, Jerzy Skolimowski, who was a kind of colleague of Roman Polanski. He co-wrote Knife in the Water, I believe, for Roman Polanski. The reason I think that Essential Killing is so interesting is it has one of the great recent performances from Vincent Gallo, who can be a bit of a wild card when it comes to acting. But for this film, Gallo won the Best Actor Prize at Venice, and the film screened equally to great acclaim in Toronto. And as you said, it's dialogue-free. It's a film which is almost like a fable for war. It's set during an unspecified time, but it became a controversial film because it has clear parallels with the Taliban. Vincent Gallo plays an escaped Taliban soldier who kind of escapes into the wilderness and has to survive on his wits. It also features a couple of very, very interesting performances from non-actors, people that Skolimowski cast because of their look. And it's mainly set in snow, and it makes great use of landscapes, and it has a kind of brutality to it, but it also has a poetry to it. But it also does have some very good action sequences, but it's probably the most arty action film that you're most likely to see.
Yeah, so I've seen it being described as an art house born. Yeah. Which is always a weird thing to do. Maybe quickly you could tell us how, you know, when you put the posters up in your cinemas, whether you're surprised at the quotes that are sometimes used to describe these things. I suppose to get certain types of bums on your seats, I suppose a quote like that is quite useful.
Yeah.
But are you surprised by some of the things that go on?
Yeah, I mean, it's a known fact that most trailers for foreign language films, they don't put any dialogue on because, you know, they want people that are seeing this film. Some people are put off by subtitles in foreign language films. We're lucky, Cousin, we don't have that problem because most people coming to us, they're expecting to see subtitles in our cinemas. But with regards to posters, you know, a film like Essential Killing is a film that you hope is going to have perhaps a wider appeal than just in Curzon cinemas. It has guns, it has chases, it does have a lot of elements that other people may be looking for. You know, this isn't a film which is going to set the multiplexes alight, but it will have an appeal to quite a young demographic.
On the plus side, it has no subtitles.
It has no subtitles, yeah. It has no subtitles. I mean, I think in the entire film, I think there's three or four lines of dialogue. You know, it really is pared down.
So, Essential Killing, The Thinking Man's Born.
The Thinking Man's Born, out on April the 1st.
Out on April the 1st. And coming up next, we've got a couple of documentaries. I wanted to ask you about Senna, about the late, great Ayrton Senna. Why is this in Curzon Cinemas? What stops this from being a Top Gear viewer's fantasy film?
The interesting thing with Senna, I was lucky enough to see a rough cut of Senna a while ago because I know the director quite well. The director of Senna is a young British director called Asif Kapadia, who Curzon have supported Asif's films right from the start. And Senna is his first documentary. It's brilliantly put together. I mean, it's put together in a way which doesn't go the kind of Kevin MacDonald, James Marshall. It doesn't use any reconstruction. It's all archive footage. And the footage that he's managed to amass is extraordinary. And I think that the reason that this film spoke to me personally, I'm not particularly interested in motor racing, but the one motor racing figure I did like was Ayrton Senna. Ayrton Senna came from quite a privileged background in Brazil. But as soon as he made his wealth, the majority of his money he gave away to people with nothing. And he was a national hero. And there's some fantastic footage from his funeral where people lined the streets of Brazil. And the people that were lining the streets were working class people. He gave away a lot of his money to charity. He did have a playboy lifestyle. You know, he was a very charismatic figure. And the way that he drove, the reason that he was a legend in motorsport is because he had a real devil-may-care attitude. Universal, that are releasing the film, it's quite rare for a studio company to release a documentary like this. They are positioning Ayrton Senna as a real kind of counter-culture figure. You know, the posters make him look a little bit like Steve McQueen in The Great Escape. It doesn't do a soft soap. You know, it doesn't just show this man is a great man. It shows him with his foils and his fables. But you still can't help by being inspired by him. As I said, he's one of those kind of anti-hero figures that you kind of know that you should distrust, but you find yourself just being completely swept away by his charisma and his kind of sheer balls, to be quite honest with you, if I can say that word.
Well, I think that's probably the quote that's going on the poster.
Yeah. You've done the sheer balls.
You've done it, yeah, exactly. And the BFI have been down into their vaults, and this is The Great White Silence. This is about Scott's trip to the Antarctic. This is all original. It's been re-soundtracked.
Yeah, I mean, I watch a lot of films. On average, I reckon I watch 3 films a day. I do watch a lot of films. And it's very rare when you do what I do, when you've been doing it for the amount of time I do it, that you watch something that really reminds you of why you love cinema. And The Great White Silence is a film that did that. It was made in 1924. It's by a director called Hubert Ponting. And Hubert Ponting was the official photographer and filmmaker on Scott's trip to the Antarctic. And the film has been released in various forms throughout the years. It was released as newsreel footage. But it was really kind of put together as a film in 1924. And last year, the British Film Institute, they cleaned up all the material and they retinted it. And it screened at the London Film Festival. And I think it's fair to say that amongst all of the great films that showed at London, you know, high-profile films, Never Let Me Go, Black Swan, with huge amounts of talent, I think The Great White Silence was the one that really had the cineasts salivating. And what the BFI have done, they've colour-tinted the film. You know, so it appears in all these beautiful colours. There's these sequences that are in kind of purples where they discover these kind of caves of huge icicles. And there's these blue-tinted sequences where Ponting goes out and films the penguins. And not only have they kind of made the copy and it's released digitally, completely pristine, they've also had it rescored by Simon Fisher-Turner. This is a film that really reminds you of the power of moving image. And it's a film which has been inspirational for a lot of subsequent filmmakers, because obviously Ponting wasn't there when Scott and his men met their terrible end. And there are sequences which are kind of reconstructions, you know, and I think it's one of the earliest films to do that. It kind of imagines what it would have been like. You know, so amongst these imaginings, there is also some of the most remarkable sequences I've ever seen committed to film, you know, and anybody that thinks, why would they go and see this film? I think it's something that you can be completely inspired by.
So would you just quickly give us the release date for The Great White Silence at BFI?
Yeah, it's released by the British Film Institute. It comes out on May the 20th, and it's playing at BFI Southbank, but it will also be playing at Curzon Cinemas.
And now, just to talk quickly about a theme that surrounds two interesting movies, but two interesting German filmmakers, Wim Wenders and Werner Herzog, two people that you thought perhaps wouldn't necessarily be rolling up their sleeves and delving into the sci-fi, we think sci-fi-obsessed world of 3D. Mm. And also at Curzon Cinemas, we don't necessarily think you're going to be putting on a big pair of sort of yellow and red spectacles. But what do you think brings these two filmmakers to such a sort of multiplex genre or a multiplex treatment?
Well, I think the interesting with 3D is a lot of filmmakers for some time have been talking about 3D as a format, and rather than using it as a gimmick, which I think it has become. And I think a lot of these filmmakers, and David Lynch also, was kind of thinking, well, why should it only be for huge budget sci-fi genre films? And I think both of these directors are interested in technology. You know, Wenders has always been very interested in technology. You know, he's made some fantastic films in CinemaScope. And Herzog is somebody that kind of likes to explore and break boundaries. So I think 3D is something that for them just created the idea of possibility. And I think for the kind of films that they make, and if we take the Werner Herzog film first, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, it's a film that Herzog genuinely thought could only be done justice by filming in this very, you know, 3D is a film which really brings you into the moment. And Cave of Forgotten Dreams is a film which is set in these caves in southern France, where they've discovered these cave paintings, which are the oldest, they're believed to be the oldest art created, and they're certainly the earliest example of these cave paintings. And what Herzog does with these cameras is he takes you into this world, and he replicates the kind of sense of discovery and awe that the people seeing these paintings must have had for the very first time. And I really think that unless you have this kind of tremendously immersive experience, the film wouldn't work in the same way.
We always think that 3D has to jump out the screen at you. It sounds like Herzog's doing something where you become immersed into it. It's about depth rather than about the surface.
Absolutely. I mean, depth is the key word. It gives you this kind of depth of vision. You know, I think this is a film, it is released in 2D, but I think it's a film that really does need to be seen in the 3D format to give you the full glory. And I think that's similar. If we come on to Pina is a film about Pina Bausch, and Pina's work was very much about movement and very much about the use of space and physicality. And with Pina, Wenders thought, the only way I can do this film justice, the only way that I can really kind of capture the sense of scope and breadth of Pina's work is to do it in 3D. And I generally think that when you watch Pina, you will see 3D used in a way it's never been used before.
And these are auteur films. I mean, they're both German filmmakers, one making a film about cave paintings and one making a film about dance. This is a world away from Avatar and Pirates of the Caribbean 4 and Spider-Man Rebooted or whatever it is. But can these films be enjoyed just as a matter of pure spectacle, enjoying, as you said, the directors do, enjoying the technology?
Absolutely. I mean, I genuinely think that when you see Pina, you will not have seen... I mean, Wenders basically invented his own camera to make the film. I think you will not have seen it on that scale. But, you know, you mentioned about the idea of them being auteur films. Because of the subject, I mean, Pina Bausch was tremendously popular in the world of dance, and unfortunately she died relatively recently and would not have seen the film completed. But since we announced, I mean, Pina had its world premiere in Berlin at the Berlin Film Festival, and, you know, to use a rather hackneyed phrase, was the hot ticket of the festival. And since Curzon announced that they were going to be showing Pina, we have Wenders coming over for an event on April the 12th. It sold out within 18 hours. You know, we announced the tickets at 7 o'clock one evening, and by 7 o'clock the next evening, they were completely sold out. So in terms of this film being not only a kind of cultural event, it's also becoming a commercial event as well.
And briefly, I just wanted to ask you also, as programme director of Curzon, what that entails as a person that writes about movies. You get sent screeners, you get sent invites to screens. Are you on that sort of gravy train, or are you far ahead of the loop in terms of kind of knowing what's going to be in your cinemas?
Yeah, I mean, I have to be ahead. We because we produce our own in-house magazine, you know, we tend to work a long way in advance. And unlike multiplexes, you know, we currently operate 7 cinemas. At the moment, they're all in London's West End. And, you know, it's anticipated that 50% of a specialised film's box office will come from its West End run. So we do have quite a lot of power and quite a lot of responsibility. I'm already thinking about films for our cinemas for January, February next year. You know, so quite often you're a year in advance. The reality is, it doesn't take a genius to programme The King's Speech. It takes much more nous to put something on like Enter the Void or Heartbeat Detector or Of Gods and Men, you know, a recent real success from Xavier Beauvoir, which has nearly done £700,000 at the UK box office. You know, a two-hour plus film about monks, you know. And that is the real pleasure of what I do, is helping...
Is that in 1D?
That is in 1D, yeah. Okay.
You know, it's actually like an altar.
But, you know, that's the real pleasure of what I do, is taking these films that don't have huge amounts of marketing spend and getting them to audiences. You know, that's what I take pleasure in.
Well, Jason Wood, Director of Programming for Curzon Cinemas, thanks very much for joining us. And as for the Sheer Balls poster quote, I guess Asif Kapadia owes you a check in the post.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Cheers.
Thank you. Thanks.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back after this.
And you're back with Monocle Weekly, where it's time to say goodbye this week. It's been nice being in here for about a good hour and 5 minutes.
It was quite a packed show, wasn't it?
It is. I mean, we're all over the place. But we're going to be here next week as well, which is good. There's a lot to... well, I mean, aside from the fact that we have to sort of get the locks fixed in our building, because the weather has been absolutely stunning in London. And if you notice that Andrew sort of likes to get up and down out of his chair, Rob, and he gets a bit of a chill, and he's got to close the door, and then...
Can I just say, what I like about the new office is you can open a window to control your temperature. You don't have to kind of have an air con.
You don't have to go to the Fujitsu and like...
No.
Yeah,
and
true.
I love it. I just like... get the window on me. But it's been that funny kind of temperature. It's sunny outside, but...
Sun goes down, it gets chilly in the park, and then the cross breeze, a bit cool.
Yeah.
Double Cardi weather.
I've got a blanket under my desk just in case I get nippy knees.
An underrated facet of the new office
nippy knees
is the is obviously there's a lovely big sort of professional kitchen downstairs. Mm. We have a small one on each floor.
The double panini machine.
Yeah.
Is that the exciting bit?
That's quite. I'm not personally a massive fan of the panini. I like all the sinks and I like all the oven and things.
I didn't realize. I just thought it was a panini press that we had in the office, but in fact, it's you can actually grill steak on it as well.
Is it? It's a Foreman-esque.
Yeah, nice. I'm not sure what you could do baking wise. I know you're quite excited about that, Andrew.
You can press your shirts as well. Get a very nice crease on there.
Despite all the abilities to chill things, we've got the sort of fridges, all the rest of it. The best temperature to serve wine at is after having stored it in the server. that's actually.
Was it bubbling over?
No, good because the fridge makes it too cold. But obviously the cooler, the server has its own air conditioning.
Oh, does it?
To keep it cool, to keep it running because it's
a big. You'll notice that people are storing drink next to the server.
I love that.
I shouldn't have told you that. You're
server and a chiller. I like it. Excellent. Well, that's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills and our sound engineer is Chris Sharp here at the Sound Company in London. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, of course, you can catch up with us daily via our monocolumn on our site. And also, our Support Japan project is in full swing, and you can buy one of our special edition leather bracelets that we've done in collaboration with Brooklyn of Tokyo via the shopping pages of our website. Next week, we're still in London, but for now, from London, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Band.
Goodbye.